Blog Talk Radio.
Real sports guys. People's Radio. It's RSG up in your headphones. Allow me to introduce
the illustrious Queen Anne Hoop. Marcus the Game Changer. The Seventh Jackson. D. Will. The Ill Executive. He's like Suge Knight without the anger management issues. Phil P, the sports PhD. This dude is coming at you from all angles. He's got all the bases covered. There's not a whole lot about sports this brother don't know.
Can you dig it, sucker?
Featuring Ray, Justin Page, Eric Hamilton.
RSG fans is like, woo!
Now, I blame it on Nintendo.
It's definitely a gin party around here. Definitely a gin party.
Don't bring any Kool-Aid.
It don't get no better than this, baby.
I want winners. You guys act like this. Pick it up a little bit. Okay? Get your chin up. Smile. Smile. Anybody can be peachy.
Don't get no more realer. All right, welcome to the Real Sports Guys with Real Guys Talk Real Sports, RSG Renegade Radio. How's everybody doing this evening? This is your host, Marcus the Game Changer, and I'll be holding you down with my cohorts, my partners in crime this evening. But before we get into all that, let me introduce these fellas. All right, these are some Kaiser Soze type Tarantino style usual suspects. All right. Your King Schultz, Kaiser Soze, Marcellus type cat. To my right, I got my man, D. Wills. Holla at the people.
What's up? I'm still trying to do some regression analysis on your COVID stuff, but I'm here, ready to go.
Hey, you're gonna have to find a different statistical measure, man, because the win shares measure is bulletproof on my COVID analysis, man. It don't make COVID look good at all. It just don't. That's the way that works. You gotta find something else. You barked up the wrong tree with that one.
Is it foolproof, though? Is it foolproof?
I don't know, man. A fool can mess up anything. He's a true fool. He can mess up anything. Never underestimate the power of a true fool. That voice is chiming in is my man, 100 grand. CLT Sports PhD. What's happening, Captain?
Fellas, I was sitting here watching a ball game earlier this evening, and I just saw something very disheartening, very confusing, very confounding. And I'd like to take an extra 60 seconds to discuss it, if I can get the green light.
Go.
I'm watching the Indiana-Minnesota game, college basketball, and I see a young man drive to the basket and he gets fouled. Okay? Nothing extraordinary about the story yet. Until I saw his number flash by, I said, wait a minute, could that be, you know what, let me grab the DVR remote. There's a young man wearing 11 for the Indiana Hoosiers. Wow. That's Isaiah Thomas's number. I mean, what do you have to do with Indiana to get your number retired? I just didn't get it. It's like watching UCLA and seeing somebody out there with Walton's 32 or El Cinder's 33. I mean, it just doesn't add up. So I'm a little bit stumped by that.
Yeah, Zeke did wear 11 there, right?
Oh, absolutely. No doubt.
Yeah. Interesting. Maybe he should get his wind chairs up.
Ouch. Kicking a man while he's down.
That is interesting, though, man. IU is different, though, man. IU is very different like that, man. If there has been a school, in my opinion, in my lifetime as a young man and a sports fan, IU has had some interesting grudges that they've held against some former players and coaches, Bob Knight in particular, and Zeke as well. Like, yeah, you're right. What does Zeke have to do to get his number in the rafters? Interesting. I don't know if they're just trying to stay away from Zeke because he just doesn't have a great rep, but IU is an interesting place, man. I don't know, Devon, if you could shed some light on that. You got a lot of Big Ten connects.
IU like baseball. They fool themselves. So, you know, you can't tell the IU story without Isaiah. Period. So,
is there a story without Isaiah?
You can't tell an IU story without Isaiah. There is a story without Isaiah.
You can't tell the Big Ten story without Isaiah.
No, exactly. Exactly.
Which
I think one day should lead us into another conversation, man. We need to have that debate here. Which area of the country produces the best hoopers? Because, you know, as you talked about not being able to tell the Big Ten, you can't tell a Chicago hoop story without Isaiah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you talk about producing ball, Chicago's up there. You know, I like to say they're number one, but that's just me. You know, there's a lot of folks that'll talk about Michigan and Detroit and the Flint area and some other areas in Michigan as far as producing ballers. We need to have that debate, though. We'll get into that at some point. We got a lot of debates that we need to have over the next couple of months.
And I'm ready for that. And I'll be bringing back the wind shears to make my own. Because you got some Chicago players with wind shears I love. But we'll work on that.
Yeah, we will. We'll dig in. All right. So this is the portion of the show called The Intro to Let Them Know. This is where we give you a quick rundown of what we have in store for you this evening. During the funky editorial, we're going to talk about the NCAA. Man, talk about foolproof. The NCAA just cannot get things right. There were some improprieties perpetrated as they tried to secure evidence against the University of Miami with the Shapiro cat and that whole case. And now they got to fire NCAA investigative employees. Employees of the investigative team have to get suspended, removed, fired, all under Mark Emmert's watch. It's real interesting, man, and NCAA continues to bungle these situations. So we're going to get into that a little bit. Just talk about,
another Indiana guy, Emmert.
Oh, is he? I wasn't aware.
He used to be the AD at was he the president at IU, Devon?
He was president at Washington, and then I think he was somewhere before. I mean, he had a good reputation for as an administrator and being effective. He's totally surprised me these early days, he's saying the right things. I don't know what's happening here lately.
So, in other words, he has no association with Indiana. Please forgive me.
He may have been an Indian. I think his last stop was at, I want to say, Washington.
Okay.
I looked it up. Scratched that one from the record.
Oh, man. You're killing me, man. You're killing me. So, Mark Emmert is not having anything to do with Indiana. But he does have a lot to do with the NCAA being kind of a mess right now. So we're going to get into that and talk about, you know, do they need less power, more power? Where should their power be? What role should the NCAA play in governing the institutions that it serves? We're going to hit you off with the five on the black hand side. We're going to get into some NBA talk. Playoff races are heating up. We're getting into March. You know, we're past the All-Star break. Time to check in and see where certain things are at, certain teams are at, and where the league is overall. We're going to talk to you about the NFL Combine. The Combine went down this week, wrapping up today. A lot of good stuff coming out of there. Maybe we'll talk about KO, maybe we won't. But we'll get into all things Combine, hit you off with some college hoops. We can get to that. And then we'll be closing the show out. So, you know, we're going to keep it real, real succinct. And go deep, all right? We're not going to spread ourselves too thin. We're going to give you a few things and really hit them hard, all right? So we're going to jump right in.
Fellas, one thing we need to say.
Yes.
Shall we say it, y'all?
Yes.
Melvin,
right.
Jimmy,
yes.
Coleman,
yes.
Ryan,
yes.
Say it.
Yes.
Everybody want to get funky one more time.
All right, so in this edition of the Funk Editorial, we're going to dig in. Now, you talk about the situation at Miami with the booster who's, you know, giving improper benefits to players. You got the Penn State situation with the paternal report now coming out and how the paternal family is saying the NCAA took the free report as kind of law and didn't really do their due diligence in investigating it any further than what the free report presented before levying sanctions. I mean, you have just tons of situations where they've levied, in my opinion, unfair sanctions upon players or schools for very, very, in my opinion, petty penalties. So what I'm going to ask the fellas right now is what role should the NCAA be playing, and what is your perspective on the NCAA as the governing body? D. Wills, how should the NCAA be operating?
Well, first of all, I mean, when the President of the United States has to make a statement regarding the practices of the NCAA, there's an issue. Part of it is there's too much of a conflict of interest. I think the enforcement part needs to go outside of the NCAA. They have used in other areas. I heard them talking about using other entities to handle the kind of enforcement rather than having that in-house. I think it's a conflict of interest. You can't have the people who are investigating tied too much into the system. So I think that's part of it. And you need to protect it because the big thing is this is a $1 billion operation. So the whole rhetoric is around the student athletes. Is around the pursuit of true undergraduate education, but the overplay of this is really this $1 billion industry that no one really needs to talk about, and so then they make all of these decisions that's about money and allowing that kind of flexibility, and so they got too many things. I think. You know, when Emmert first came on, what I liked about him is, and he had proven in his role as a chancellor, is being an effective administrator in terms of getting down and really taking the NCAA and all its regulations and trying to get it down to something that's manageable and doable. I thought that was a great approach, and that was a breath of fresh air. But, you know, when you look at what's happened with Miami, He'll listen to some of the people talk about him. He only has two people reporting to him. Yeah, he doesn't know anything about this. You know, it makes it very hard. So, you know, I think they are a move or two away from having some type of external intervention coming in. I said it was a slippery slope when the Penn State stuff happened because of the way, not the outcome of the investigation, but the way in which they went about it in terms of trying to be real quick to judgment and whether or not it was within their jurisdiction. But the process was so aggressive, and they didn't follow their normal protocol around that, and I knew that was a slippery slope. And all that stuff is coming back to haunt them.
Okay. And PhD, when the whole Penn State situation was going down, I think you were the kind of the voice, D. Wills as well, but the voice saying, look, slow down, pump your brakes, let's not go there so fast. Do you want to say I told you so? I mean, I'm going to give you the airspace.
No, thank you. I'm going to pass on that.
Well, how do you feel about the NCAA right now and where it is as a quote-unquote governing body?
So there's a PhD analogy coming. I feel as if the deacon, who isn't qualified to manage the church fund, the church building fund, is managing the church building fund because he's a deacon. And so,
right.
You know, and we've all grown up in those situations. I say that because I think it's time for the NCAA to look at somebody to run and manage the academic amateur school side of it, but also bring in somebody to manage the operation and the sports side of it, the athletic side of it, and perhaps even a third person to manage kind of all this other stuff that's coming up. I mean, you look at NBA teams. At one point, GMs took care of everything. They took care of the basketball side, the operational side, and you see a lot of organizations moving towards a split. Now, one of the downsides of that is there's nobody in charge. And so we're thinking accountability. Who can we point a finger to when things go wrong? Well, I think that's the exact issue with that mentality. I think the NCAA needs to look at more of a distribution of power in terms of having more, the ability to have more oversight over different aspects of the function, because this is a huge, huge business. It's a huge, huge organization, and the oversight is almost unrealistic. So I would call in, you know, kind of like how USA Basketball did it. You know, I was listening to Coach K. He was on with Mike and Mike this morning, but specifically with Dan Patrick. And he brought the idea of, you know, the NCAA, I mean, he was talking more about the basketball portion of it. We need to look at bringing somebody in like Jerry Colangelo, who came in to USA Basketball and really got that situation cleaned up. So I think trying to find somebody who has a background in academia, you know, and even in athletics, and trying to find somebody to manage all that is, you know, might just be too much to do.
Yeah, I hear you. And I think there does need to be kind of more of a specific focus for the NCAA as an organization, as a governing body. Like, what are you overseeing? I don't know. I mean, there's compliance, and in compliance, what does that? I mean, what does that mean? Schools still aren't. A lot of schools aren't graduating guys at a high rate. A lot of schools are still giving them proper benefits. A lot of coaches are still doing recruiting inappropriately, breaking those rules. They provide all these rules for the kind of the field workers, the micro-level cats. But then they're letting institutions shuffle, move, go back and forth from conference to conference, Boise State's in the Big East 1 minute. Now they're not in the Big East. Now they're back in the Mountain West, and you have all this conference shuffling. And to me, what is your purpose? And when everything came out with Penn State, that was my thing, was that, you know, if you guys are going to continue to throw the book at the little guy, the kid who, you know, yeah, he sold his, A.J. Green sold his own jersey, got a couple thousand bucks for it, but it's his jersey. You're going to throw the book at him, then you got to throw the book at Penn State. You know, the NCAA has backed itself into a corner where it has to have these knee-jerk reactions because it, just to be consistent with its own knee-jerk reactions, you know, when you constantly overreacting to stuff, well, you got to consistently overreact to things. Those people are going to start to say, hey, you're playing favorites. You know, you're picking this battle over this battle. When it looks like this, you're overreacting. When it looks like this, you're not. And that's what I don't like about the NCAA, is that when it comes to important things, they kind of stand idle. When it comes to players getting money, then they want to grandstand. Then they want to make these big, have these big press conferences and levy these huge sanctions. But when you're talking about, again, the money that's being out there and the money that's being generated by, and I don't even know if you can call it an entity. I mean, it's so loosely, the NCAA as we know it, when we think of sports organizations, when we think of the NBA, when we think of the NFL, there's a cohesive message that all of the members kind of ride for. The NCAA is so loosely held together because there's so many institutions that it represents. I don't know if it needs more of a regional, like the NCAA South, the NCAA, you know what I mean, like a more regional focus where there's a body, there's a head body, and then there's these little pockets that kind of manage certain regions and just focus on certain regions. I don't know, but there needs to be a different model because I feel like, again, it's a money grab, and it's like somebody came in and just, you know, because somebody walked to a strip club, just threw money in the air, and the strip club manager is like, hey, who came in here and threw money in the air, and why is everybody chasing after this money, and everybody's just scrambling for the money, you know. You got the DJ, he ain't playing no records no more, you know, people that jumped off poles. You know, it's just mayhem. And that's what I feel like the NCAA is right now. It's mayhem. There's money to be had with these TV deals and these bowl games and NCAA tournament appearances. And people are just going after it. People are just chasing the money. And every now and then, the manager of the club will catch somebody taking more than their share. And they want to set their wrist while they count money in the back themselves.
Only on realsportsguys.com will you see an analogy with a deacon follow that with one on a strip club. Only on RSD.
We are always stretching. But let me add, because, see, the thing about it is the driver for all of this is football. And it's the one entity that's not controlled by the NCAA. So the movement is not controlled. A lot of this is not controlled structurally and through authority by the NCAA. They have no control over where teams move and how conferences develop. So the important stuff, like you said, that they should have control over, they have no control over. Yet they're going to fine you for, you know, getting an extra dinner or a plane ticket to get somewhere. And so that's the struggle that they have, is that and part of what Emory came in, and he wanted to figure out how to address that, because their rules were not 21st century rules. Even the whole idea of texting and how people communicate, the rules had not really caught up to how technology has changed and how people connect and what's realistic. Even the whole idea of practice time and how you want to engage players. And there is no penalty for even not reaching some of the benchmarks with the ways in which they define success, whether it means, I mean, they have this very detailed way in which they have these indicators of success, which also includes, you know, if you go to, you know, Calipari, if you go to the pros, and I mean, there's ways in which you can talk about the outcomes of student athletes, but there's no accountability around those markers. So you know, there's a lot of things they could put in that would be that would demonstrate an investment in student athletes. You know, the thing we just talked about in terms of securing scholarships, making them renewable. They made it optional rather than saying it should just be renewable. Those were presidents who made that decision. See, everybody likes to put stuff on coaches, but those were presidents and chancellors who had the opportunity to decide or not and really could have brought some integrity back to the situation, and they chose not. They made it optional. So when you Marcus, you were talking about doing regional. They do regional stuff for accreditation, and institutions take that very seriously. Maybe that's a model that you like you suggested they should look at. But then you got to control movement. You know, the accreditation works because you can't pick up University of Wisconsin or you can't pick up South Carolina and move it, right? Because you don't like
hey, for the right price, they'll figure it out.
You know, you don't like the way you're being evaluated. So I think, you know, and it's hard when you got that much money on the table. You know, it was probably cool back in the 60s and 70s, but the money now is real money, right? And so, yeah, this is – so I think the crux of it is really about what's the essence of amateurism. Like, we just got to come to terms with what does that mean? We got to start at the root cause. Like, what is it? Because the whole defense mechanism, all the rules are around this whole notion of amateurism, right? And so I think the first thing you got to do is you got to redefine what that means in this 21st century context and then go from there. So I think that's the best way to kind of do that.
Yeah, and my perspective is that's an antiquated idea, period. When you talk about the money that's being made to expect the folks who are at the forefront of why that money is even there to somehow maintain some sort of purist Pollyanna perspective or stature or status where there are billions, and I mean billions of dollars. I mean, you're asking these athletes to walk through a rainstorm and not get wet. You know what I mean? Like, as much money is being generated by them, they're not supposed to see any of it. I just think that that's an antiquated idea, and when you talk about amateurism in the context of the 21st century, you really have to you can't even call it. You have to come up with something else to
yeah.
expect amateurism to exist today. To me, is hypocritical because you're asking players to ignore the reality of their worth. And you don't ask institutions to do that. Institutions are allowed to chase every buck they can get. So if no one else is being asked to do that, coaches aren't being asked to do that. If today a better job opens up for Coach X, he can leave. No penalty. He can go wherever he wants to go. He can chase the money. And so everybody else gets to be aware and acknowledge their full worth, except for the student-athlete. And I won't even call them student-athletes, athletes, because the student is lowercase and very small letters in quotation marks and italics. But it's not a real label anymore. These cats are athletes. They're athletes for hire, however you want to put it. But the PhD, what's your perspective on this whole idea of amateurism in the 21st century? Is that something that is a realistic expectation anymore?
I don't know, especially when you look at these huge revenue sports like basketball and football. I mean, I can't help but think about a friend of our show, Alan Sack, and, you know, his book, Counterfeit Amateurism. You know, the title says it all in terms of what his thoughts is concerning, big-time revenue-producing sports in 2013. I mean, I also think about Hall of Famer and the Honorable Alan Page I was on. He talked about, and we had him on a few months ago, about looking at a separation between the athletic side
of college sports and the educating side, you know, and kind of separating the entities of athletics from the university to a certain degree. And in some regards, the NCAA tries to do that, but at the end of the day, the presidents have the most say in certain things. So it's almost like you have this governing agency that is managed and led by these presidents, and there's just too many conflicting interests, in which one of you gentlemen mentioned earlier in the conversation. So the system is broken. It's I see it more as a self-serving system. And, you know, a big issue I have, again, pulling on some of our past guests, Ramoki Huma, the president of the National, help me out, Devon, National
Players Association.
That's right.
College Players Association.
I mean, he would tell you about the failing graduation rates that we have for some of these student athletes, and how perhaps there needs to be a system in place to get some of this revenue back to the student athletes to help them in their post collegiate playing careers, you know, whether it's towards grad school or something like that. So I just think there's a lot of misses in the system, and for all this money that's being produced, $1 billion industry or something close to that, you would think that the product, the amateur student athlete, would be benefited greater throughout the situation. So that's something that I always struggle with. It always frustrates me with these conversations.
Yeah, and here's a piece for me that I think could clear all of this up. It's a philosophical thing. It's a rhetorical thing. But stop trumpeting yourself as this. Stop trumpeting the whole student athlete piece and saying we're trading an opportunity to participate in collegiate athletics for, you know, access to higher education. Stop saying that. Take away that Pollyanna perspective and let's deal with this as if it's a business. And I think the NCAA could actually start to solve its problems. And I think that's something you guys are alluding to. And Dr. Alan Page talked about a little bit, is that we need to just call a spade a spade and keep it moving, and let's operate as if it is what it is, and not mince our words, and not rhetorically try and paint ourselves into a corner where we're trying to uphold these values that aren't consistent with our actions.
But I think the problem they run into is then, you know, you start running into issues around tax exempt. You know, all this is about how to leverage your funds. So they're running into issues around tax exempt and a lot of these other areas that, you know, that's why they came up with student athlete. You know, that's why they came up with these ways of framing this, because it's about having that tax exempt status. So, you know, I think they would fare better if they came up with a really good system for reinvesting in athletes. And I know we came up with a couple models that we had out here in terms of either getting some and investing some stuff away, in terms of I think Ramogi might have talked about this, and if the athlete doesn't do it, but it's something that would be like a legacy structure that would go to one of their dependents if they decide to go to the same institution, and that scholarship would there be for a full ride. Some of that type of investment that is about the reinvestment in education of either the athlete or their son or daughter, I think that would at least get them going down the right route. You know, I don't think people are opposed to resources coming in if you can figure out how to do it, but if you can figure out how to make that impact, I think it's back to what Phil said. If you can start to demonstrate that you are beginning to invest in the people who are producing the money, and that investment, if you're talking about the percentage of what they make, is small, but the impact could be large, and it would help them with their public relations issue. But, you know, nobody's doing that. And so I think that's where they're slipping, is that it wouldn't be that major investment. You know, Ramoki put together a pretty compelling you know, formula for how they could do it, and not a lot of money. And, you know, so you know, they're not knocking that kind of stuff out of the park when that's pretty simple. When they would spend that same kind of money, they probably waste more money than that at some of these bowl games. If you look at the amount of money that's wasted in bowl games around receptions, everything else, I bet you that's the amount of money it would actually take to pay for that.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. I think there's some definite flaws with the NCAA as a governing body overall, because, again, your biggest moneymaker, you don't even have any say over how things are run. And that's evident with football. Football is not only driving the bus, but it's paying the rent. It's getting the groceries. You know, it's keeping the lights on, paying the utilities and all that good stuff. And where football goes, the NCAA must follow. And it's definitely a conflict of interest, particularly the NCAA's interest versus the student-athlete's interest. And then also the NCAA's interest as a body versus its member institution's interest. They got to do what they got to do to get the money that they got to get, these universities. And, again, something with the system, everybody is kind of a separate. Again, there's no cohesion, in my opinion. You know, the student-athletes are the student-athletes and the institutions are the institutions, and then there's the NCAA, and everybody's got their hand in the same bowl, you know. Instead of, look, this is our bowl. We the NCAA, this is our bowl. These are our cookies. And we're going to tell you how many cookies you get, and you're going to get cookies off this plate, and you're going to get cookies off this plate, and we're going to divide this up and make sure everybody's going to get cookies now, but we're going to make sure we're controlling what cookies everybody else gets. And instead, you know, the cookie jar is broke, and, you know, everybody got chocolate all on their face and crumbs is everywhere because everybody's getting cookies and eating them. And that's what I feel like over and over and over with the NCAA. It's just a free-for-all. There's no rhyme or reason to how this whole thing operates. Whatever wants to happen, whatever some school president wants to happen, can happen. That's why the Big East is disbanding. One of the best basketball conferences ever is disbanded. You know, obviously one of the most dominant of the last 10 years, at least. You know, you got the Big 12 football was raided. The SEC in football continues to get stronger. The ACC in basketball is getting stronger. And none of it holds true to those values that the NCAA, again, trumpets of tradition, of pageantry and connection to history and all this kind of stuff. It just doesn't fit.
And if they try to get control of football, because right now they don't, then, as I said before, during the Penn State stuff, because of the way the process came down, you know, it was crazy. But, you know, because of the way they're really getting down to basically three conferences, you're looking at a situation where you had the right alignment, people would just walk away from the table.
Yeah,
you get the SEC and a couple of people, you can walk away from the table. And I think they're afraid of that.
Yeah, because, I mean, they got their hands in that same cookie jar, but they don't have any control over who's bringing in the cookies. You know, the folks that's bringing in the cookies, they supposed to be the boss. Well, football is bringing in the cookies, not the NCAA. So
yeah.
Football is telling them what they don't do with the cookies and what they better not do with the cookies. You know, how many cookies you get to eat. And you're supposed to be the boss. It's all crazy, man. It's all crazy. PhD, I'm going to give you the last word on this whole NCAA thing. What's the next step? I mean, what's in game here? Like, is this going to evolve? I mean, where is this evolving to next? That's the question I want to ask in your eyes.
Change, and hopefully change of a sustainable nature, change that'll be implemented with the hope to be adaptable and flexible to change as the needs of student athletes and just all these issues that are coming up in 2013, man, in today's world. So That's a very abstract statement, but that's the best I have because it's such a mess. I just hope change is on the horizon.
Well said. You're listening to The Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com. RSG Renegade Radio brought to you by Resistance Digital. Make sure you check out the folks at resistancedigital.com to hook you up with all your digital needs at a very reasonable price. Make sure you email our boy LR, Larry Randall, at resistancedigital.com. We're going to get into the five on the black hand side, like right now.
Five, on the black hand side.
Yes, sir. This week's five on the black hand side, we're going to talk NBA talk like the RSG guys do. All right? That was kind of redundant. The guys is in our name, and I said RSG guys.
That's okay. Yeah, we'll work with it.
I don't think nobody caught that with me. Stickler for details. So, number one, in five on the black hand side, James Harden. All right? We're going to be revisiting this. Started back with our NBA special with me and my man Justin Page getting after it, going at each other. It even kind of started with you guys questioning whether or not James Harden should have been one of my top 25 players in the league. So here's the question.
Yeah, I'll own that.
Is he a superstar? PhD. James Harden, is he a superstar?
I thought you was going to hit us with a I'll wait, you know. I think so.
Now, how do you define superstar? Because, you know, that's a very topic that's statement that's a name that's overused a lot. Kind of like elite quarterback.
I say he's a star, but superstar for me is
I was talking to PhD
over multiple years. So you're asking for the definition, but I'll leave.
That's right.
I'm gonna go back to my corner and wait for the referee.
I mean, the boss has spoken. Okay.
Right. He should jump in like, yo, man, I'm finna talk. I'm just finna talk. I pay the bills. I'm finna talk.
Right.
Don't be shushing me.
The boss. Yeah.
Don't be shushing me.
I'm a grown man, dog. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Go ahead with it, D. Go ahead with it.
No, you go back. I think you were catching your rhythm, but he just... I'll let you go back. I'm gonna go back to my corner and chill until you come out.
You gonna have your moment, boss man.
I have my Tyson socks on and no shirt.
You gotta go off Kobe on me, man. Calling your own play.
Hey, I'm trying to do me.
So he said, I need some touches.
So I would say, you know, you brought the elite quarterback, and that's exactly where I was going. Superstar, I mean, it really depends. I mean, when you go superstar, the list might be very, very, very short in today's NBA. Okay, I mean, you talk Kobe, you talk LeBron, you talk Durant, guys who are megastars off the court, but also are still playing at a high enough level on the court. So if we want to expand it, I would use a comparison like an elite quarterback or lead at your position. And so if you go that route, I would say anybody who's playing at an all-star level, you know, perhaps you could consider a star. A superstar is a different stratosphere. With that being said, I think James Harden is making the argument that he decides to be, like, he deserves to be in the discussion of a superstar, as well as he's firmly placed in the group of a star, of an elite player.
Okay. D. Wills,
you like the referee to kind of pull your hand and kind of have him come on out.
Right.
I agree that he's firmly sitting at a star and his trajectory towards a superstar. You know, when y'all were describing superstars, y'all were using one name terms, I mean, to describe them. I heard LeBron. I heard Dwayne. You might say Durant. We're still
is CP3
him
a superstar?
We're still calling him James Hart. And
what was that question, PhD?
Kobe.
Devon, is CP3 a superstar?
CP3 is a superstar. You give him, so I would say one name and then you give him something like a CP3 or the Chief, whatever it might be. But there's something that tells you that they're a superstar, but I think he's well on his way. You know, I think the statement against Oklahoma when he had the 46 was to say, you must have forgot. That was his Ice Cube moment. That was Ice Cube moment looking back at Easy and Dre and saying, you know, I'm out here, but I'm doing my thing.
No Vaseline.
Yeah, no Vaseline. I didn't want to put it out there like that. But
hey.
So it was. And I have to say personally, because I wasn't quite sure because of the way that his body language was carrying him. That was my whole criticism in the playoffs. He looked like he's more comfortable in the background. But I think he's really grown up out here in this space before our eyes. I'd like to see what he's going to do in the playoffs with the lights on and how he needs to lead his team down the stretch with L.A. coming. But I think he's well on his way to being there. I think if he has the same type of performances next year, now you can say, okay, now he's making a name for himself.
His stat line
okay.
was sick. I mean, let's go over his stat line, because when I first saw it, I was looking at it through my fantasy basketball mobile app, and I said, oh, okay, he's having an average week. Okay, 46 points, 14 and 19 from the field, 73%, 8 boards, 6 assists, and 7 for 8 for three-point range. I said to myself, oh, he's had a good couple of games. And then I look closer, and I'm like, no, this is for Tuesday. And or Thursday, whatever day it was. To me, the most impressive thing about his game, and the reason why I think that he is a player that's here to stay, is that he leads the NBA in free throw attempts. And historically, guys that have been in the top 10 of free throw attempts throughout their career, we're talking about the Iversons, the Jordans, the Barkleys, these are guys that can make things happen. They don't have to rely on a jump shot. They don't have to rely on somebody else creating them shots. So, to me, this is a guy that has the potential to put up even stronger numbers in terms of assists than what he's doing right now, because I think they have something in Houston. And hopefully, I mean, they have a lot of cap space, man, the Rockets do this coming summer. If they can put a couple of more pieces around him, and I think right now what he's showing this year, and Devon, you're right, we need to see consistency, but I think what we're seeing so far this year is here's a guy that's showing that he can lead a team offensively. And so hopefully we're not seeing a guy emerge as here's a guy that can be a great player on a bad team. Okay? He was a supporting player on a very good team in Oklahoma City. So hopefully we can see him to continue to develop, to take that next step in which he's making guys around him better.
I think with that is that his other numbers, I mean, what he does in rebounding on defense, his assists, his steals, I think he's setting a tone for his team about playing hard on both ends. I don't know if he's the kind of guy that does a lot of talking about people following. His win shares, I bet you, is up. You know, if I'm using, you know, game changers method. So I think he does all those other little things. Because when you talked about stat line, it's like all those other things that he's willing to do that is part of his leadership that you don't see with some of these, even these other superstars, you know, that he does well beyond scoring. That's what I'm impressed by.
Yeah.
Okay. And for me, my definition of a superstar, and kind of where I begin to differentiate between a superstar and a star, one, of course, is your impact on the court. Do you come into a situation and you take a team that isn't supposed to be playing well, and with you on the squad, they're competing? Now, are they competing with the elite teams in the league? Maybe not. But they're competing more than they would have been without you. And that's what he's done in Houston. Houston, at the beginning of the season, I think a lot of people had them pay for the lottery, not a playoff spot. And a lot of that is attributed to his presence. I still don't think he's in a superstar. He's on that trajectory. He's a star. He's a legit cemented star. The other thing about being a superstar, you have the on-court performance. Then you also have the off-court profile. And when you brought up CP3, he's got those Allstate commercials. When you start doing commercials outside of athletics, you're big time. You know, at that point, when you're doing insurance commercials, you're a superstar because that means your name, your persona carries weight in a realm outside of athletics, outside of selling shoes, outside of selling, you know, T-shirts and power drinks and those kind of things, energy drinks and those kind of things. When you start to move into selling cars, when you start to move into selling insurance, when you're selling, you know, phones, whatever, when you move beyond just athletic stuff, that to me is a sign that you have kind of arrived as a superstar. When you get that first endorsement deal for, you know, Gillette, you know, razors or things like that, that move beyond just like athletic stuff. That's huge to me. And so I would consider CP3, and Harden isn't there yet. He's not doing those kind of commercials yet. But I think the thing with him is that he understands who he is as a baller, but also as a persona. So he's keeping the beard. He's keeping the mohawk because that's distinguishing, you know, that makes him stand out. That makes him recognizable. So he's going to hang on to that. And I think that's a smart move on his part. He's, of course, got to keep playing the way he's playing, which is awesome. Here's the second part of this particular part of the five on the black hand side is, where do you rank him amongst the top in the league? Is he in your top 15? I had him in my top 25 way back at the beginning of the season. I'd probably move him up into my top 15, close to my top 10 right now. And I haven't done it. I have to sit down and go through to see where he would really rank out. But just off the top of my head, he's at least top 15. I'd be lying if I didn't say I thought he was top 12, at least, top 12 in my book. Where does he stand for you, PhD?
well, right now he's at 26 points a game, which puts him, I believe, sixth in a league scoring behind LeBron, Kobe, Durant, Carmelo, and LeBron. he's fifth. I don't know. I think at the beginning of the season, you know, in the offseason, you had him in the top 25. That was certainly a lively debate. I was questioning whether or not he should be 25 or 35. But you had him in the top 25, and, you know, and I think this is evidence that you were right. I would be inclined to put him in the top 20. And in some ways, I take a pass because I have not seen him play much this year. I get into the NBA around now, after All-Star Game, a few weeks after the NFL season. So I would say safely in the top 20, perhaps as high as the top 15.
Okay. Shug, what you got?
Well, I mean, based on, if we just looked at performance for this year, so I'll take it for how he's performing this year, and then if you think about the game, which is more than just this year, okay? So for this year, he's a top 10 player for this year. Like, okay, if you look at the eyeball test, looking at what people look at, win share, look at all that, regardless of where people fit, this year I would say his performance tells you he's a top 10 player. Now, just looking at the NBA beyond just kind of this year's performance and where he's going, I would put him because I believe he's going to – I believe I've seen enough to help me – to tell me about how he plays the game, how he approaches the game. Game changer, you said this real thing. It's an important thing, I think, you know, you're watching players evolve. Do they stay ahead of the scouting report? His best asset is from his neck up. He's a great player, great athlete, but he thinks the game. And I think he's going to continue to think the game. And so I see him probably between that 10 and 14 range. Now, this is somebody who didn't have him in the top 25. But I see him in that 10 to 14 range. Because of this, But I think just his performance this year, I mean, he's one of the most exciting players this year. And he's put some games together against great teams. We're not talking about bad numbers against bad teams. He's put some games up on some of the best teams. He's performed well. So when they knew he had to score. So that's how kind of how I rank him.
Yeah, and you know, when you start to really project out and think about, you know, if you're drafting the league and guys you would take, there aren't a lot of guys you would take over 23-year-old who's dropping 26.
Yes.
Giving you 6 boards and 6 assists on a nightly basis and doing it in a very efficient way, getting to the line 9 to 10 times a night and then hitting 85% of those free throws.
Right.
So that's something he could,
he's got the kind of game he could still be playing at a high level at 32. Because he's
right.
not playing
he's
the kind of game.
He's got that Pierce in him, you know, where it's like
right.
his game doesn't depend on some. He's not Westbrook, where
yeah.
it's going to be interesting to see how what kind of a player Westbrook is when his athleticism starts to wane. If it ever does, you know what I mean? Of course it does, but. Sometimes it takes longer than others. I mean, D-Wade, he's not the athlete he used to be, but he's still better than probably 80% of the league. You know, on a good night when his knees are feeling right, D-Wade will still give it to you. So, you know, some of those guys just don't lose it. That's why they are who they are. You know, that kind of athlete, that kind of athletic ability just doesn't dissipate. Just doesn't disappear. Not without some tragic type injury. You know, we'll revisit James Harden again at the end of the season to give our final assessment. But, yeah, I'm hanging on to that agenda that I dropped earlier in the year. Shout out to Justin Page. He fought a valiant fight. But I think this one is over, bro. I think it's over. It is so over. So I'm one up on that one. As we get into number 2 and the 5 on the black hand side, we got to talk about the San Antonio Spurs, man. Jay-Z once said it, will they ever fall off? No. These cats just keep coming back. I mean, year after year, for the last 10 to 15 years, this team has found a way to get it done. And right now, they're again at the top of the league with the best record, 44-14. I mean, they're up on the Thunder. They're up on the Heat. What is it in San Antonio that keeps them going? You know, what do you see in this year, D. Wills, with this Spurs team that why are they winning so much?
It's culture, and the two consistent pieces over that time you described is Tim Duncan and Greg Popovich, meaning that they set a culture. You know, I'm a Steelers fan. They're like the basketball version of the Steelers. Just a culture. They bring pieces in and out, but you know the culture is going to be the same. It's going to be interesting when Duncan moves on, because even though he's not, he's still contributing at a pretty high level. You know, obviously Parker is beginning to take over, but when he's not in the locker room, when he's not traveling with you, when he's not around the team, you know, will Parker and some of these other people step up in, and where would they get some of that other superstar play? Popovich retires. What do they do? So, you know, I think that, you know, their long-term success is going to depend on what's that transition to Parker and then to the next superstar, however they draft and however they make it happen. That's going to be doing. But, you know, they just got a way of playing. They're unselfish. Popovich is what I say a lot of coaches need. You adjust to the players that you have. You know, it's funny that the great coaches don't have systems. Right? There's some system to it, but there's some fundamental things they do. But they package that in different styles, right? So Popovich is playing a different style, but some of his fundamental stuff is still there. You know, attention to defense, sharing the ball, doing some of those things. They might be pushing the tempo a little bit. So that's the secret to their success. And if they're going to continue to move forward, whether or not they can maintain that when you lose Duncan or if Popovich ever retires, those kind of things, can they maintain it?
Yeah, and I'm going to somewhat contradict you a little bit, but not quite. Because I was just going to share when you made a point earlier about Popovich and how they fit guys in and out of what they do. And I was reading the SI article, the Sports Illustrated article about where they interviewed Phil. Phil Jackson. And Phil Jackson was talking about how the NBA is a copycat league, and a lot of coaches see something, and then they incorporate that into what they do. But not a lot of teams or guys have systems. And he pointed out Pop specifically, named him by name, and talked about how he does have a system, and they have a way of doing things. And I think that's what you're getting at, is that he has Pop has a framework in which they find guys who work within that framework. Whether you call it a system or not, I don't think there's not a name. It's not like he's running a triangle. There's nothing that you necessarily give a name to with the Spurs. But
what I meant is
in a framework of how they all work together. And he caters that to who he brings in, and he brings in guys who are going to continue to add to that.
What I just want to add, and I'll let you go with that, is that I think they have core principles that govern how they do things.
Yes, yes.
So he used the system, but I think Phil Jackson, I think Larry Brown, I think Popovich, I mean, you just go down the line, there's some core principles they have that are never going to change no matter how you see that stuff flow. But you're going to see that core principles play out, right?
Right.
That's what I think he does have. He'll never go away from those. You understand? So I agree with you. I think, and I don't necessarily call that a system, because I think they're playing a different style than he's played, but those core principles are still intact.
Right.
Even when he had two twin towers to now where he's got he's playing a different style, but those core principles have been there all the way through his tenure for the San Antonio Spurs.
Yes. Absolutely. PAD, you're looking at the Spurs. What are you seeing? And what do you think of their prospects? Last year they bowed out early. Do you think they're going to contend this year? Is it going to be another year where they get into the playoffs and they get the wrong matchup? Which, if you're the best team in the league, there really should be no wrong matchup. What do you think about this Spurs team's chances as a title contender?
So I see the Spurs as a team that just simply reloads. They have a system and they have pillars. Duncan, Parker, Pop, Ginobili, and they have other guys who can come in and play their role. It's almost like a video game where you're in legacy franchise mode and you have a system. You have a system that allows you to win 5 out of 6 championships, you know, all the time, you know, and it's almost like it's a video game for Pop. You know, he figures out how to rest the players, how to motivate them. As far as this year, you know, I get excited about the Spurs, but then I never get overly excited about them being a title contender. Well, not a title contender, but the favorites. And even if you look back over the 4 championships that they've won, I would say that every year they weren't the clear favorites. And the years that they haven't went to the finals, they were actually higher seeds in some situations. So this year, I don't see them losing in the first round. I think the key difference this year is that their younger players have an extra year underneath their belt. Danny Green's playing very well. Leonard, I think, is developing to be just a dandy of an all-around ball player. And they've got a couple other guys as well that have stepped up. So I think this extra year is really helping them. And don't look now, but Duncan is balling. 17-10, he's second or third in the league in blocks with almost 3 per game. I mean, he is playing pretty well. And, again, this is on limited minutes. So don't be surprised to see Duncan put up some monster numbers this year in the playoffs.
Yeah, Timmy is Timmy's back to being Timmy for sure. And it seems like they're better with the ambush, the Spurs, than when you see them coming. Anytime teams see them coming, they kind of get knocked out when nobody's looking, and they can sneak up on you and jump out of the trees, you know, attack from the treetops. You know, they're good at that. So moving on to number 3. And the 5 on the Black Hand side, Derrick Rose. There's been a lot of stories coming out about whether or not he's coming back, whether he should be coming back. His brother came out and said that the organization should have made a trade Why would he rush back if the organization's not going to do anything to improve the team? One, until his brother starts scoring some buckets, he needs to shut up. I mean, I get it. You kind of guided this young man, and you kind of helped him get to this point. Yep, you helped him get there. Now, don't mess it up. That doesn't give you the right to mess it all up either. You know, just chill. D. Wills, what do you think? Should Derrick Rose come back this season, or should he just wait till next year?
I say wait till next year. And because, I mean, so much of his game is on his explosiveness. And, you know, in the Bulls' management should be, and I know it's hard for an organization. I mean, the team is playing tough. They've had some, you know, they had a couple of tough games here lately, but they've been competing. He needs to be a leader for the long term. And I would not chance it. I would try to let him heal and come back strong next year and, you know, do some things in the offseason to get him ready, allow for him to work on his game. So that's how I would look at it. You know, he's their long-term investor. He's the face of the franchise. They don't have a number two to go to. So if he goes down in flames because he came back too soon, the franchise is in trouble.
Yeah, and they don't have a number two, but they do have Luau, who is an excellent number three.
number three, if he's your number one, he's your number three, if he's your number one, he's your number three, 17 and 8, right, if he's your number four, all snap, you got a ring.
PhD, what do you think about this whole Derrick Rose Chicago Bulls situation? What did you think about his brother's comments more specifically?
I'm with D. Wells. Be quiet, okay? Siblings, just be quiet. And for Derrick Rose, I think it's very simple. He needs to do what's best for him. And in turn, he's also doing what's best for the organization. So if he's not ready to play, don't play. If he's not 100%, don't play. Those are my simplified thoughts.
Yeah, and, you know, at the beginning of the season, I was calling for the tank job. You know, I was saying, hey, tank, and tank some more so you can get a high pick and use that, you know, just go with the Spurs model, man. I mean, when Robinson got hurt in 98, 99, I mean, or 97, 98, they just said, you know what, forget it. we're just going to be bad this year. You know, we could bring David back and we can push him to come back, but, you know, this is a kid, Tim Duncan. We might have a shot at it. Let's see what happens. And lo and behold, they get the first pick. They get Tim Duncan, and the rest is history. Sometimes you need to play chess and not checkers. And I think if Rose to rush himself back for this season, one, by the time crunch time came, you know, for this, if he comes back, he's coming. He should be coming back to lead this team to the finals and possibly a championship. By the time they get to that point in the season, he will be just barely entering his groove space where he's getting into his rhythm and being who he usually is. If that's the end game, it's not worth it. If you're not going to have him at 2 or 3 months of being in his groove and being in his zone, then what's the point? Because these first couple of months, you're easing him back. He's going to be on a pitch count, so to speak. He's going to be playing limited minutes for the first month or two. He probably won't play back-to-backs. So how much of a rhythm, how much of a flow, how much of the actual real Derrick Rose that you're counting on, are you actually going to see? So if you're not getting vintage, full-out, beast mode Derrick Rose, then why even press the issue right now? You know, that's where you got to play long ball and say, you know what, even if we get you back, even if we get you on the court, say, middle of March, we got April, May, we're in the playoffs. You know, by the time we get to June, if we're lucky enough to get to June, you're kind of in a groove. You're showing us moments of having it back. That ain't getting us nowhere. Moments is not going to – they need him to be what he was before he got hurt for them to be able to contend with the Heat.
for them to be able to get out of the East and possibly win a championship. He needs to be D. Rose pre-ACL injury. If he can't be that this year, then y'all just need to put it on pause and just chill. So, you know, so when people, when D. Rose is coming out and saying that he may not play this year, I get it. I wouldn't be in a rush to play this year either. For what? For what? I mean, right now I don't see them as a contender. D. Will, do you see the Bulls as a legit contender with D. Rose coming back from this injury? Do you see them as a serious contender?
I mean, even if D. Rose played a full year, it was going to be tough for them in the East. Just because they still needed to build some continuity offensively. And now, you know, like you said, you don't have enough time to really develop their rhythm. Because their issue is not on the defensive end of the court. It's other than D. Rose, can you get continuity going offensively? And you got some teams like Indiana, you got New York, you got obviously Miami, you got Boston, and all those teams will give Chicago all they can handle. And so I don't see them. I see them. They're always going to be a contender because they play great defense. They're going to rebound. That's always going to keep in the game. So every game is going to be tough. But I think, you know, the difference down the stretch is when great defensive teams find a way to isolate and push D. Rose away from the hoop, who else can make something happen? I don't think they're there yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to have to. Yeah, I'm going to have to co-sign that. So who, PNG, who are your contenders in the East? Who you think that, we know the Heat are right now. I mean, again, LeBron, what LeBron is doing is ridiculous. I mean, it's video game-ish. You know what I mean? It's seriously video game-ish. I mean, those are video game numbers where, you know, you just got him running a certain play and getting the ball on the wing and just dunking it over and over and over. Those are the kind of numbers you come up with when you're talking about this cat shooting 60% for a month.
Right.
As a wing player. So who else can – who can challenge the Heat in the East?
Nobody.
All right. And we shall keep it rolling. As an event, going on to our last and final one – or I'm sorry, I say number four. As an event, how would you grade – this year's trade deadline as far as excitement? I mean, what would you give it? I mean, there's a lot of build-up. PAC, what would you give this year's trade deadline?
I'd give it an F. And if I could, I'd give it a... if it was possible, I'd give it like a T or an S. I mean, it was...
So you hold it back.
Right. You know, I would conservatively give it an F. It just didn't have much firepower to it. You know, when J.J. Redick, okay, is the biggest name moved, that's a problem. That's a problem. But, you know, I think it just speaks to teams are nervous to make moves. New collective bargaining deal, you know, this luxury tax, another thing is coming up. I think there's just so much unknown that teams are going to either try to build to the draft or try to make a move in the off season where you're going to get more value or, you know, play your hand in a free agent market.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're on to something right there, because I think with the new CBA, you have to be a little bit smarter about what you take on as far as contracts. And I think that's really going to inhibit people from trading in season. I don't think it'll totally cripple it like it has in the NFL, where basically nothing happens in season as far as trades. But yeah, if I could put a dunce cap and sit the trade deadline in a corner, that's what I'd probably do. Because as you put it, when J.J. Redick's your biggest move, something ain't right. D. Wills, what would you grade the trade deadline this year as an event? This is something that you would be interested in watching and paying attention to.
You know, it gets a low grade, but what I would say, it's kind of like, you know, because I think past trade deadlines are kind of like people were doing it like we do on fantasy basketball. The GMs are trying to get a splash, you know, sending out crazy stuff. This felt like grown-up stuff.
You know, it's like, you know, I've been at the club, spent a lot of money. Now I'm going to really start to figure out and budget and figure out what's going on. And so there were no splashes, but they were what I would call solid moves. Because I think there are a lot of teams that either think they're in position to do something this year, or I think they're going in the right direction, if not to make a good run this year, but to do something next year. And so some of the moves that, like Eric Maynard going to Portland, that's not a splash move, but that's a good depth move, right? That's a move that
right.
gives you a little bit of something there. You talk about Jordan Crawford going to Boston. That's not a splash, but I think that's a good move when you start to put the whole package together for the Celtics. And so it's those kind of moves that I saw, you know, teams making that I think are real smart kind of GM moves that I think were really good. And so I think, you know, Kenyon Martin, yeah, you know, 10-day contract, he's doing this stuff. But, you know, that may be a playoff move, you know. So those are kind of things I thought were good moves that weren't big splashes, but I thought were just solid moves. And the trade that Houston made to get Thomas Robinson and Francisco Garcia, I mean, those are, you know, those are, I think, just solid moves. So, yeah, in terms of TV and for SportsCenter, for talk shows, it wasn't good. But for, like, basketball people, you know, when you're trying to build depth, you know, I would say these are moves that Game Changer would make if he were in contention for our basketball league. You know, because he's even got a cap. Will pick up somebody, you'd be like, why did he pick that up? But he's trying to just solidify the numbers in the team. It ain't a splash, but it's gonna make it solid come playoff time. That's the kind of stuff I saw today.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. you know, those moves are again excellent for us basketball junkies. But overall, Jim Pop. Anybody trying to watch J.J. Redick get put on a new jersey? Nobody likes the J.J. Redick to the Bucks press conference.
Right, not me.
Nobody set the DVR for that one. But I feel you. I think there were a lot of sneaky good moves. Again, when you talk about teams trying to position themselves to just with an extra piece, with adding depth, getting a little, filling some holes in their roster. Overall, I think what plays a bit into it is that right now there wasn't a big move to be made this year. One, I don't think nobody in the East in particular has any chips. The chips aren't right. There's nothing that these teams could have done to really put themselves in position to contend with the Heat. You just kind of got to ride this one out. This is when you got to play chess a little bit and say, hey, we got to make it look like a good fight, but we probably know we're going to lose. You know, that's one where you suck it up and you go in there against a 6'7", 300-pound dude, and you try and give him what you can, but you know you're going down. And in the East in particular, I mean, what were the Knicks really going to do? I mean, they have a bunch of deals. And I mean, you're talking about trading Amon Shumpert. What are you really going to get back for that? You know, what are you going to get back for Amon Shumpert? A defensive specialist right now at this point in his career, athletic kid. But other than that, you're not going to get a hold. I'm not seeing anybody breaking the bank or giving you a key piece that's going to put you over the top for Iman Shumpert. Boston, outside of moving Rondo, who was out with an ACL, I mean, you could have packaged some of your young talent, but then you're really mortgaging your future with two aging superstars in KG and Paul Pierce. So what was the move to be made there? I don't know. You know, and Brooklyn trying to revive the whole Atlanta East Coast thing, bringing Josh Smith to Brooklyn, to me was just a bad idea. I did not see that going well. I think that's a team that just needs to chill for a moment and figure out, you know, that's the cat that's just making too many moves. You know, that's the cat in your fantasy league that's just trading all the time. And is making so many trades that at the end of the day, it's like, man, your roster, you had a good team before
right.
you got a hold of it. You know? So I don't think there was any move for Brooklyn to make. Indiana stood pat because, I mean, you're getting Danny Granger back, which in the end is like getting an all-star in the trade.
And Chicago stood pat because there really wasn't anything for them to do. I mean, they don't have a whole lot of pieces you can move other than Carlos Boozer. Nobody wants Carlos Boozer. That's just the truth of the matter. But speaking of Brooklyn, as we move on to number five in the five on the black in the five on the black hand side, you listen to the Real Sports Guys, RSG, RealSportsGuys.com, Renegade Radio. We're in the five on the black hand side, about to wrap this up with number five. We got Deron Williams. Speaking of Brooklyn, Deron Williams is really falling off. I know he's dealing with an ankle injury, but it begs me to ask the question to the RSG fellas. Is he still a top five point guard in your book, D. Wills?
I'm thinking that he's, and I have to look at my numbers again, but I'm thinking he's moving into that 6 to 8 range. And a lot of it is, I mean, Deron's taken some hits ever since Sloan left. I mean, his stock has been falling ever since that Sloan, and it's about, you know, people don't want to call him a coach killer because he's a nice guy. He has that persona of that. But there's something about him that feels passive-aggressive around authority. And he's got to rectify that. And then he's got to lead. He's got enough talent around him that they should be performing on a high level on a consistent basis. We're telling me he's not leading the way he should be leading. And so I put him in that 6 to 8 range. I mean, he can do it any night. He's got great skills, but his team, he's not like CP3 that's like that to demand his team playing every night. I just don't see that imprint on it every night.
PAZ, where is he ranking your rankings? I agree with you, D. Willis. I got him in that six to eight range as well. PAZ?
Yeah, I have him outside of the top five, and it's not because it's not what he's done to get him out of the list. I think other people have emerged. So in my top five in no particular order, I have CP3, Westbrook, Tony Parker, and I also include D. Rose and Rajon Rondo. Even though they're injured, if I'm looking at the guys that they're not injured, I think those two guys are still in the top five. And I'm not overly caught up with his poor shooting percentage. I think that he's playing with another dominant guy in the backcourt, and they're still trying to figure out how to play together. And so I attribute that more, I attribute his shooting issues more to that than a decline in skill. I think he has the ability, because of his size and skill set, to have a good 10-15 game stretch, whether it's this season or next season. All of a sudden, we're looking at him as a top 1, 2, or 3 point guard in the league.
Okay, and I have him in my top five. I got CP3. I got Russell Westbrook, Kyrie Irving, and then you talk about D. Rose and Rajon Rondo, and also with Tony Parker. And you know, Tony, I think, you know, little French Tony, he gets kind of swept under the rug a lot when we have these conversations, but the kid is legit, and he has been for a long time, and so I squeezed, you know, Tony in there as well, as a kind of a tie with those injury cats. And D. Wills is kind of on Deron Williams is kind of on the outside looking in right now. But again, I think, you know, he and Joe Johnson have to figure out how to play together. Joe can be a ball pounder, which definitely probably killed some of Deron's assist totals. But overall, you know, he's still putting up decent numbers for a guy who's playing on a bum ankle, so you can't complain very much there. He's just not playing at the level we're accustomed to seeing. So, you know, it is what it is. Again, you listen to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, RSG Renegade Radio, and it's time for the Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Now we're going to get into our Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Resistance Digital Solutions. Are you tired of running to the boys in blue? Are you done with listening to sales staff trying to upsell you technology that you don't need? We've all been there. So, what did the Real Sports Guys do? We contacted Resistance Digital Solutions for all our technology needs. They are not there to meet sales quotas or make profit margins.
They simply just want to sell you what you need at a fair price. From iPads to PCs to flat screens, TVs, or intricate home theater systems, they customize every solution based on your needs. Check out their website at www.resistancedigital.com or email them at sales@resistancedigital.com for your custom technology solutions today. All right. D. Wills, you know how it goes, my man. We need more dogs.
I'm going to, and actually I changed it this afternoon. This is amazing. My dog of the week this week is Dennis Rodman. The U.S. government could not get North Korea to the table. No one gets them to create arms and not doing testing. And you look in the paper, and Dennis Rodman, and on the news, is walking through the airport. He's in North Korea with the Globetrotters, with news media all around him. Only the worm can, at 51 years old, do something that very few in the U.S. government can do, is get a heartbeat going with the North Koreans. There's so much energy around him when he walked through the airport. And I just, you know, as a former bad boy, I had to give him love. Dennis Rodman is my dog of the week. If y'all haven't seen the story, y'all got to read it.
Okay. So Rodman, former bad boy Dennis Rodman gets D. Wills, dog of the week, PhD.
We need more dogs.
I'm going out of left field on this one. I'm going with Geno Smith, the quarterback from West Virginia. I liked his swag at the NFL Combine. He compared himself to Aaron Rodgers, and not Aaron Rodgers at the Combine 7 years ago. No, he said, I see a lot of Aaron Rodgers in me. And so I think that swag is going to benefit him. And the big board, you see him as a mid-round talent. But I think he might sneak into the top five, man. Oakland's looking to make another mistake. I mean, a pick at quarterback. So.
Oh, man, a little hit of Raider Nation right there. A little diss to Raider Nation. For me, my dog of the week this week, I'm kind of going off the board to a sport that we're really going to talk about, but I got to talk about NASCAR. For one, prayers out to the folks who were injured in the crash. Crazy. PAZ, you've actually been to one of those situations. Not necessarily a crash, but you've been to, was it the Indy or the Daytona?
Indy 500.
Yeah, so you've actually been to one of those kind of racing situations. And, man, just the idea of, like, metal, hot metal flying at you is kind of scary. So, you know, prayers go out to those folks. But my dog of the week is Danica Patrick. Breaking down those barriers, being the first to do anything, to me, is always major. Whether you're the first of your ethnicity, you're the first of your gender, you know, you're the first from your state. Whatever, when you're the first to do something, that's, to me, that's a big deal. And that's something to be honored, and that new ground has been broken, and that's always a part of our evolution as a people, is to have those first. So shout out
to Danica. Shout out, and I want to say shout out to Rockton, Illinois, where she's from, Onondaga High School.
So that's all we got for this week's edition of The Real Sports Guys. All right, Steve the Renegade. Make sure you check us out at realsportsguys.com. If you're not getting the podcast, make sure you hit us up at realsportsguys.com and make sure you get that downloaded. We can get that plugged in right to your iPhone. So, you know, Thursday morning or Wednesday morning, you wake up, boom, there's a new RSG show right there for you. You can also get our specials when we have our specials as well. Those get popped in right to you. So make sure you hit us up at realsportsguys.com. Also, make sure you check out the plugs at resistancedigital.com. Any parting shots, fellas?
Hey, Inside the Park is coming back. First week of March.
Oh,
get ready.
Yeah.
Fellas are back. They're back.
Excellent.
Better than ever.
Excellent.
Well,
that's all for this show. Make sure you check us out next Tuesday. Make sure you're on the lookout for Real Sports Guys. The Inside the Park Show is coming back with baseball season coming. Check all of that out. And as we always do, peace.
Playoffs? Don't talk about playoffs. You kidding me?